This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I'm Michael Williams. I'm director of the Wheeler Centre, and we started this year in this very hall with our traditional gala night of storytelling. We end it tonight with one of the world's preeminent storytellers, Jada Boomrad. It's been an extraordinary year. Yeah, hoot. Cheer. It's a good thing. Being interviewed by the incomparable Andrew Denton. In the intervening months, we have told many stories at the Wheeler Centre. We have discussed many ideas. We've had many arguments. We've heard from architects and politicians. We've heard from human rights lawyers and novelists. We've heard from musicians and podcasters. On one memorable occasion, we heard from a podcaster who insisted on dancing. It's been quite a big year. And it's only been possible because the Wheeler Centre team are as tireless and imaginative and generous and brilliant as they are. And I'd like you to give a big round of applause for everyone who works at the Wheeler Centre. But the other thing that happened this year, you might have noticed, is that 2016 was an absolute bastard. And for most people, it became harder to take comfort in the stories that we tell ourselves. It turned out that our stories might be wrong. They might be inadequate. One of the comforts I've taken, apart from working at this extraordinary organisation, is reading people I love. And one of them is Rebecca Solnit. And I want to read briefly from her, The Far Away Nearby. She said, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live or to justify taking lives, even our own, by violence or by numbness and the failure to live. Tell ourselves stories that save us, stories that are the quicksand in which we thrash and the well in which we drown, stories of justification, of accursedness, of luck and star-crossed love, or versions clad in the cynicism that is at times a very elegant garment. Sometimes the story collapses and it demands that we recognise we've been lost or terrible or ridiculous or just stuck. Sometimes change arrives like an ambulance or a supply drop. Not a few stories are sinking ships, and many of us go down with these ships even when the lifeboats are bobbing all around us." We believe in the power of stories at the Wheeler Centre, and we're thrilled to have the guests that we have on the stage tonight. Tickets are already on sale for our gala night of storytelling next year, and we're going to keep telling stories and try and make them clear-eyed and honest stories that hear each other's stories, that tell the truth. Australia is a place built on a set of stories and a set of lies. It's built on the land of the traditional owners. This town hall is on the land of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to the Wurundjeri people, their elders past and present, and the elders of other communities who might be with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the incomparable Jada Boomrad and Andrew Denton.
Listening to Radio Lab.
Radio Lab.
From
WNYC.
Thinking about sound as a touch.
More like touch.
I asked him, how does sound get into or touch your brain? Take us on that journey.
It's just waves of vibrating air. It's just your voice.
Touch. At a distance.
Beginning your voice box compresses air, and that air travels through space and time into my ear. A little tunnel. Waves of diffuse vibrating air focused and channeled into my eardrum, which vibrates a few very small bones. And the little bones transmit the vibration into this salty sea where the hairs are. And the hair cells are fascinating. The hair cells become active when they are literally bent by a wave. They bend like trees in a breeze. And when these hair cells bend, charged molecules flood inwards and activate the cell.
So the sound triggers the bones disturbs the fluid rocks the hairs.
Yes.
And then the hairs set off essentially electricity?
Yes.
Huh.
That's the language of neurons.
All those changes from waves to bones to electricity, all those things were a trip on their way to being heard. It's only when the electricity finally forms a pattern in your brain, only when it's deep inside, that's when you hear something.
It feels to me more like touch. Sound is kind of touch at a distance.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Please welcome the host and co-creator of Radiolab, Mr. Jad Abumrad. It's wonderful to have him here. Hey. And we played you that little tour de force called Sound as Touch for those that haven't heard Radiolab before, because Radiolab is a magnificent meeting place of science, humanity, wonder, and extraordinary production. Just to set the scene, how long would that have taken you to produce that? I'm guessing at least 10 minutes.
That two-minute bit actually took probably a week and a half to make.
Yeah.
Because it's funny, I mean, I haven't heard that in a while, but one of the sort of secret things I did there was I took the sound as touch at a distance, that phrase, and I broke apart the syllables and used them to create electricity, to create the sound of water. You can do various kind of synthesis techniques to create these weird sounds. So I made most of that using that one sentence, which was idiotic, which was an idiotic challenge. And we never talked about it, but so I could have probably done it in a day had I not decided to do it the way I did it.
So I'm guessing you don't get out a lot.
No.
And also to set the scene, when you first started broadcasting in 2002, the audience was what? People you could name?
It was maybe like those six people, sometimes eight. You know, I mean, it was very, very small. And I mean, we started Radiolab as a radio show, hence the name, and it was broadcast on the AM frequency in New York City. And because AM frequencies sort of travel great distances, what would happen was that the radio waves would bounce off the water and land in Canada and screw up their radio stations. And so they would actually, the FCC, the sort of broadcasting kind of arm of America, they would mandate that we cut the power of our signal right as I came on the air. And so you literally had to hug the transmitter with your body to be able to get the show. So for the first 3 years, no one heard the show because they couldn't. They couldn't actually tune it in.
Couldn't actually hear it. And what is the average download of an episode today?
It's somewhere between 7 and 9 million, mm-hmm. I would say, depending on the month.
Mm. Well done.
Thank you.
You say that you choose ideas on purpose that you're not sure how you feel about. Talk me through that.
You know, I mean, I think the basic start of every story is you encounter something that someone tells you or something you read that just kind of spooks you, sort of haunts you. You're reading something, you're like, it just kind of infects you. You get this sort of brain fever for a second. And then you spend weeks, months, sometimes years trying to reconstruct that painfully for someone else so they can get that really simple feeling you had at the beginning. But very often the reason it spooks you is that you can kind of roll it around in your head, and you can, as you learn about one side of this issue, it gets more interesting, and then you inevitably want to know the other side. And you can't summarize it. In some sense, we choose stories and ideas that I can't simplify this. And so the challenge then becomes, can I make like an 8-minute story where this idea or the story is still complicated and complex, but it's immediate, you know, and that's a real challenge.
So you're choosing something deliberately that can't be simplified in order to try and simplify it?
Yeah, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That's about right.
You don't get out much.
I don't get out much,
that's
this is why.
Right. The structure of the show that loosely links it together, the narrative is yourself and Robert Krulwich, your co-host and co-creator, talking about the episode. And it sounds very conversational. It sounds spontaneous. How many drafts would that spontaneity go through?
I feel like I'm showing my dirty underwear here.
That's later.
It goes through, 60 drafts maybe, sometimes less. I mean, the conversation is always spontaneous, although we will sometimes map it out so that we basically know what we're doing, but it's always improvised. And
so the genuine surprise and the genuine questioning, that's your first real reaction.
Yeah, I mean, and we will do sort of, we'll do things which we'll try and preserve that first tell. So very often when I go out to do a story, I'll deliberately keep him in the dark. So I'll go out and I'll sort of, you know, do a series of interviews, report them, maybe line up some tape, and then I'll get him into the studio and then I'll tell him the story and I'll play him some clips. And sometimes he doesn't even know what story it is. And so I have no idea how he's going to react. And he'll react surprised or confused. And actually, that's useful for the tape you use on the air, but it's also useful just to know if the story's worth doing, because I'll play it for him and he'll, because he's Robert and he's brilliant, he'll always zoom in on the place in the story I haven't thought about enough. And so those kinds of like raw, improvised studio things are very useful in the storytelling. They happen to make things a lot longer, you know, so it adds to the time of the process. But we'll use like, say, bits and pieces of four or five different studio conversations and make it seem as if it's all happening at once.
And do sometimes stories get spiked because of that reaction?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd say for every 10 stories we chase, 3 make it.
Right.
So there's a lot of murder.
Mm. That's where Serial came from. That's very good. Yeah. So you were saying when we were talking before, which I didn't realize, part of the reason you made Radio Lab is because you used to listen to ABC Radio.
Yeah, I mean, one of the really exciting parts about coming here is that when I first started Radio Lab, and Radio Lab has gone through many different forms and flavors, when it was the very beginning, it was not a show about science or ideas or politics or any of the stuff we do now. It was supposed to just be a show about documentaries. It was an anthology show. And I was given 3 giant boxes of old radio documentaries and said, you know, pick some stuff from here, match this piece with that piece, and say something in between. And I was really new to radio. I hadn't ever done it before. And half of a box and a half of those 3 boxes were documentaries that were made here at the ABC. Producers like Cher DeLisse, Natalie Kestisher, were doing these stories that were just far and away weirder than anything else in the box. I mean, like, stories where you never were quite sure what was true, so they were playing with the, like, fact fiction, stories that took really strange risks with sound, that were using music in interesting ways. And I remember sitting there in the dark and listening to these stories and just trying to steal some of their moves, you know? And so I feel like really early Radio Lab is in many ways influenced by Australian radio. So it's cool to, yeah, totally. So it's cool to be here.
That was Australian radio over there.
So
we heard that amazing sound as touch. You've brought a couple of pieces of audio, an interview with a biologist called Cynthia Kenyon. Why don't you talk us through that?
I'll set that up.
How you pull this together.
I would say Radiolab has gone through many phases at this point. One of our sort of earliest, longest phases was we became very interested in trying to communicate complicated science to people who are interested but didn't have much of a science background, which is namely us. We had to figure out how do you do that in a way that is exciting and fun and compelling, but at the same time doesn't like do damage to the science, which is an important thing as a science journalist. So this is a bit of raw interview tape that we collected with a biologist named Cynthia Kenyon, who has done something kind of amazing. She has taken a worm's lifespan and tinkered with its genes and sextupled its lifespan. So if you imagine doing that to a person, average age 70 times 6, so 420 years, if you can imagine, just messing with our genes, and then suddenly we live for 400 years. It's amazing, right? But listen to how she describes what she does. And I play this not to make fun of her, but this is like a super ordinary bit of tape, like very representative. So maybe just play that first clip.
The DAF16 gene makes a protein called the DAF16 protein. And that protein binds to the DNA where other genes are, and it activates or deactivates a whole bunch of other genes in the DNA. Mm-hmm. So the way it works is that the hormone binds to the DAF2 receptor. And when that happens, DAF2 receptor kind of squashes the activity of DAF16. It turns it down, okay? So DAF16 can't bind to its genes in the DNA and make them more active, okay? So when you come along with a mutation or some other way and you inhibit the activity of the receptor, now you liberate DAF16. It's free. It springs into action, and it activates about 100 genes in the DNA. And these 100 genes each do a little tiny good thing for the cell.
Cookie, so that's a very ordinary piece of tape from a scientist. And we gave it ourselves very early on the challenge of like taking tape like that and making it dance. And so like that tape is interesting because it's like you listen to it and you kind of know what she's saying, but you kind of don't really know what she's talking about. And it's interesting, you have a grammatical tension there. I mean, you have really great verbs. You know, you got squash and leap and bind as sort of like physical kinetic words, like action movie kind of words. And then you have these nouns, like DAF16, DAF2. Like, I'm sure there's a great reason why they call it DAF, but like it's like so fundamentally unsticky. It's like a little rubber ball that just like bing, it bounces off your head. It can't get in there. So what we ended up doing in this case is what I think of as noun replacement therapy. We basically just replaced the nouns, kept the verbs. So maybe play the second clip.
Sure, what exactly is this gene doing to make them live longer?
Well, maybe we should ask the question a different way, because the worms that lived longer, they didn't actually have this working gene.
Right. When we make a mutation in the DAF2 gene, we damage it. That actually causes it not to work as well. So that actually is kind of profound. That tells you right away that the worm has a gene in it that's shortening the worm's lifespan.
Which is why she calls it
the Grim Reaper gene.
The Grim Reaper gene.
It's the gene that makes you die.
If you're a worm.
Right. So, by damaging this gene, Cynthia and her team essentially are taking the Grim Reaper and knocking his knees out.
No, ow, stop that! Ow.
Okay, so the question is, what exactly is the DAF2 doing to make the cell age more quickly?
Here's where the story gets a little weird.
Well, we found another gene. Whose name is also DAF, but it's a different DAF. It's called DAF16.
DAF16!
And this is a gene whose normal function is to keep you young. It's like a fountain of youth gene.
Yeah!
So wait, there was a Grim Reaper gene before.
Right.
And now there's a Fountain of Youth gene?
That's what she discovered. And inside the worms, these genes are struggling with each other. Here's how it works when a worm ages normally.
The DAF2 receptor...
DAF2.
...kind of squashes the activity of DAF16. It turns it down.
Silence!
And so the worm ages.
Okay. So when you come along and you inhibit the activity of the DAF2 receptor...
Ouch!
Now you liberate DAF16.
Yippee!
It's free. It springs into action. And it activates about 100 genes...
1, 2, 3...
...in the DNA.
Go!
These 100 genes each do a little tiny good thing for the cell. And altogether, it makes the cell live twice as long.
So, thank you.
That is radio as cinema.
Yeah, that's how we solved it. But it's, you know, I mean, it's like every time you do that, when we're trying to do these complicated stories, you have to kind of ask yourself. I mean, obviously, genes don't—they're not heroes and villains. They don't stand up and yell yippee. And so it's like you have to
What?
Yeah, they don't have agency, and all, so there's all of these sort of liberties that you take. But what we figured out early on is the only way to actually do it and do it responsibly is to sort of just run it by the scientist 100 times. You know, so you enter into a kind of like a co-authorship arrangement.
So she would have heard that back.
I'm sorry?
Cynthia Kenyon would have heard that back?
Yeah, we would have played it for her a few times, and she would have said, that works, but you might want to add this caveat and that caveat. And so then you sort of form a temporary partnership. And if they feel that you're serious, I mean silly, but serious, I've been surprised over the years how many people will let you make idiotic little skits about their work.
No, but they would get that totally, because they would know better than anyone the difficulty of communicating their work to people that aren't like them.
Yeah.
So they would appreciate it. I'm interested in the invisible rules that you have, the rules that you know about the show but that the audience aren't meant to see. For example, I've heard you talk about how you and Robert will argue about the shape of the show and not to let it become too silly. Yeah. So how do you draw that line?
You know, it's a natural byproduct of working with him. You know, I mean, I feel like the show is the tension between he and I a lot of the time. Not tension in a bad way, but tension and actually in a great way, in that he loves silly more than I do. He is an amazing improviser. So if left to my own devices, I would sort of order and construct things within an inch of their life, and he would just sort of dance and sing, and everything would become a Broadway show tune, right? But between us, we get to an interesting sort of place where it's very structured and built, but there's also a little anarchy, which is, I think, the tension between those two is what Radiolab is. And the same is true for the different topics. I sometimes want to do, these days, a lot more politics, a lot more stuff about geopolitical kind of things. He's much more into like snail sex, you know, and like stuff like that. So, I mean,
does he know you're talking about this stuff?
No, I don't mean that in a dirty way, but like, you know, he loves to tell those kinds of science stories, and I'm wanting to go in different directions. Yeah. But we again triangulate into some middle ground.
Do you have a safe word where you know, okay, I'm not going any further with this discussion now. Robert wins or Jad wins?
Vestibule. No, I don't know. That's the first word that came to mind.
I think you've used that before.
No, I mean, we just, you know, the great thing about our partnership is we will have different opinions, and we'll debate and argue it out. But there is that weird kind of chemistry that we have where when we hit it, we both know instantly. And so, you know, I mean, sometimes you work on these things for 6 months to a year and you get very lost. And you're doing, the beginning should be the middle and the end is the wrong way. Everything gets scrambled. You don't know what the structure is. You lose sight of what the real important questions are. But then, you know, throughout the experiments, I'll look at him and he'll look at me, and whenever we hit it, we'll just kind of, oh, that's it. So that shared sense of beauty is spooky, you know? Yeah. And that's been there from the beginning.
Have you ever had a raging argument?
At the beginning. Around the time period of the thing I just played, which is, at this point, probably 8 years old, I remember one argument. I cannot remember the content of why we were arguing, but what I do remember is at one point, Robert took his script, threw it in the air with a flourish, and I remember the way that the pages just floated through the air. And we were so upset.
How many in the team altogether? Because there's a whole bunch of producers work with you. So what's
12. We have 12 now.
And you can spend up to a year or longer on a story?
Yeah, I mean, we just did but maybe a year ago, we did a story about a hunter who paid a lot of money to go and kill a very endangered animal in the name of conservation. And the animal was in Namibia. And so we wanted to follow him to Namibia, and he ran into various permit issues. And it took 2 years. And so we worked on that story for 2 solid years.
Wow.
Just to get that one 30-minute segment.
One of the really interesting things about you and about the show, you have a background in music composition, you do all the music and the sound effects, and you view your storytelling as in some ways music. Can you explain that?
You know, I got into radio not as a journalist, but because I liked noises and sound, and I was trained as a musician, and I tried music and kind of failed at it, and then so radio was my sort of like, oh well, what do I do with my life? I'll go volunteer at this radio station, and I started volunteering. This was years ago, and somewhere early on, I kind of figured out that this is a deeply musical act, what we do. I mean, when you're talking, even the simple act of talking to a mic, you know, your voice goes up, it goes down, it gets quiet when you want to say something poignant, and then it gets staccato and loud when you want to make an emphatic point. You syncopate your voice when you want to kind of vary the ideas. Like, these are all musical elements. And particularly in the editing process, there's this wonderful thing that happens where you put stuff onto a computer. You go out, you do all your interviews, and then you put them into the computer, and they end up as these little squares in Pro Tools. And you're organizing them and trying to figure out what the right sort of sequence is between all these different sounds. And very often you have to sort of zoom out to kind of see it all. And at those moments, I'm always struck by how it looks like a musical score in those moments. You can see little clusters of instruments, so to speak. You know, this is where the orchestra comes in, or this is like the little sort of like aria that begins. And so it feels to me like composing in a way.
And this goes even deeper for you because you brought a clip, I think if I got this right, a musical psychologist, Diana Deutsch.
Yeah.
And meeting her was like an epiphany for you. Do you want to introduce the clip?
Sure. So this is, I've always had this sort of like theory that language and music, which are typically talked about as two very separate things, they meet in the middle in really interesting, fascinating ways. And I feel like Radiolab lives in that center space. One of the first times that we sort of toyed with this was in this segment. We just sort of bumped into it. This is a music psychologist named Diana Deutsch who works at Stanford. And she studies how we perceive sound. And she would make these little CDs of what she calls audio illusions, which are like playing you a cluster of tones and you hear like an illusion of some tone that's actually not there. And she'll study why is that. Anyhow, so she makes these CDs of like all these audio illusions, which she uses in her work. It's a bit weird, like why would you make a CD? But anyhow, she makes these CDs. And she was doing this one track. She was editing the CD and she was playing one clip over and over again, and then something bizarre happened. So maybe run that clip.
I'll tell you what happened is that when you do post-production, as you know, of speech, you loop things so that you can zero in on P's that sound too loud, you need to unpop, or S's that sound too sharp, and so on. So you put things on loops in order to fine-tune the way the speech sounds. So I had this particular phrase on a loop and forgot about it.
What phrase was this?
It's a phrase that occurs at the beginning of the CD in which I say, the sounds as they appear to you are not only different
from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
Now, I had sometimes behave so strangely looped.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely.
Just those few words.
Sometimes behave so strangely.
And forgot about it.
Sometimes behave so strangely. Sometimes behave so strangely.
So here's what happened. Diana leaves her studio. She closes the door, goes into the kitchen to make some tea. All the while, this loop is whirring away in the background. As she's sipping her tea, she thinks, is someone singing? Who's singing?
I heard what sounded like song in the background.
She realized, wait a second, that's not singing, that's me talking.
That very phrase.
So strangely.
But at this point,
sometimes behave so strangely.
It appeared to be sung rather than spoken.
Sometimes behave so strangely. Sometimes behave so strangely.
This is
sometimes behave so strangely.
Right? Yeah. You still hear the words, but they're sung words rather than spoken words.
It's weird. Like, it just switches at a certain point. Three or four repetitions in.
Right.
It's going, and then pow! It becomes music. And then now none of us can get it out of our head. Like, the whole office is like, sometimes behave so strangely.
Sometimes behave so strangely.
And you know what? If you do this demo and then you go back to the original sentence, it sounds like, you know, speech to begin with. And when you come to that very phrase, I seem to be bursting into song.
The sounds as they appear to you are not only different from those that are really present, but they sometimes behave so strangely as to seem quite impossible.
I have to say, this can continue for months and months. It's sort of like your brain gets altered for that particular phrase, and it continues to sound like singing for a very, very long time.
I love that. I mean, part of the joy is if you can get people to experience something along with the storyteller or along with you, and that's one of those moments where, like, everybody kind of experiences it together. Everyone's like, oh, there she's, you know, it rewires your brain in a way.
Is this what you mean when you say you like to lead people to wonder?
Yeah, I think so. It's like finding those I sort of stumbled into that idea sort of as we were doing these stories. There were these classic moments that we wanted to have happen where you very carefully construct a story, explain a bit of science or something, and you get to that moment in a story where the dreamy music comes in, and then one of us in a hushed voice says something profound and meaningful about what we've just learned, and then the dreamy music posts, and you have this moment where hopefully the heart sort of sings, you know. And I felt like my job began to create those moments, to lead people to those moments, and to sort of tell a story really carefully, seduce people so that you could get to that moment where someone could just sort of stare in awe of the world in a way. And that became, for me, like the first 6-7 years of Radiolab, we're just trying to create those moments again and again.
Because we live in a very concrete, fact-oriented world. We're going to come to facts in a minute. What is the value of wonder?
It's the wonder is like a second cousin of hope, in some sense, I think. Embedded in the feeling of wonder is a sense of gratitude, you know, that we're all here, and a sense of possibility, you know. That you sort of march up to the edge of what you know and you stand in awe of everything you don't know feels to me like the beginning of being alive in some just fundamental sense. So particularly these days where things can be so siloed and stratified and fragmented, at least in America, probably everywhere actually, I feel like wonder and hope are just something that's, if you can do stories that embed that feeling, that feels like more important than ever.
That's a really lovely thing to say. One of the things, you know, the production and the sound is magnificent on Radiolab, but in fact I noticed what you also use sometimes very powerfully is silence. Is that an important tool for you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you figure out when you're doing production on stories is you figure out, initially, if you listen to early Radiolab, there's just far too much going on because it was Jad in Pro Tools having a lot of fun. And I was like, ooh, what if we put this in? What if we put that in? And what if we layer three songs at once? Wouldn't that be cool? And what you realize very quickly, what I realized is that the ear gets tired, you know, things get too dense, and the music very quickly begins to work against you. And it begins to sort of dull and take the shine off of what people are saying. Things are never more powerful than, like, when you drop out the music, the next thing someone says sounds so important. And you realize in those moments that, like, when you bring music in, that's a move, that's an important decision you make as a producer. But then when you take the music away, it's an even more important decision. And so often what we do is you think about it in those kinds of very concrete terms. Because what you're really trying to do with your audience is I don't think people want to be told how to feel. So I try not to put music in that has like emotional content, Because you know, it's sort of like you put this sappy music in and people are sort of like, don't touch me there. You know, like, it's a, you don't want to do that. That feels wrong.
Yes.
But I do think it's important to underline things and say, okay, this is the part that's important right here. And so the way that you do that with music, very simply, is you when you put it in, so like Andrew says, and that's when things got interesting. Music in, okay? So music comes in, you're like, ooh, okay, interesting. So then it, you're cueing people's attention right there. And then something's happening, and then the music goes away, and that's the moment where the next sentence that comes out of your mouth is like, important. It lands with a thud. And so it's the entrance and the exit of music that that's sort of like your best tools in a way as a storyteller. You can create chapter breaks, you can create sort of rhythmic kind of syncopation, and you can also just underline the content.
You've said that in some ways the mission of the show has changed and that it's now to present stories where the audience can see you and your subjects struggling to deal with multiple concurrent truths. And to illustrate that, I've selected a bit from an episode that was controversial for you from 2012. It was a show called The Fact of the Matter, and this story was Yellow Rain. Before we play the first bit, can you briefly explain what the show is about?
Yeah, this was a very difficult and important story for us. And it really changed a lot about, well, the whole show. But anyhow, to set it up, we had become interested in, the U.S. government at one point had claimed that the Russians were using chemical weapons on villagers in the mountains of Laos, Hmong villagers. And the U.S. government was going to make chemical weapons in response, which is a very dangerous thing. So we were interested in investigating, were they Russians in fact using chemical weapons? Some scientists basically went over there, did a series of experiments, and what they concluded was that there were no chemical weapons. So the villagers were reporting yellow rain falling from the sky, which they took to be weapons. But in fact, what the scientists said was this: the bees, what they do when they swarm, is bees will get together and swarm, go up into the sky, and then just basically poop, bee poop. They would float down, and it would look like yellow rain. And what might have seemed like chemical weapons was just, in fact, bee poop. Now, people were actually dying. That is not a dispute. But the cause of that death is what we were investigating. And along the way, as we were investigating this little bit of science, we bumped into a very difficult interview.
Well, this is Robert Krulwich speaking to one of the Hmong who'd witnessed the deaths of his people, called Yang Eng, and his cousin, Cao Eng. And this is how that interview concluded.
I saw with my own eyes the bee pollen on the leaves eating through holes. With my own eyes, I saw pollen that could kill grass, could kill leaves, could kill trees.
But he himself is not clear whether it's the bee stuff or whether it's other stuff, because there was so much stuff coming down from the sky.
You know that there were chemicals being used against the Hmong in the mountains of Laos. Whether this is the chemicals from the bombs or yellow rain, chemicals were being used. It feels to him like this is a semantic debate, and it feels like there's a sad lack of justice. That the word of a man who survived this thing must be pitted against a professor from Harvard who's read these accounts.
But as far as I can tell, your uncle didn't see the bee pollen fall. Your uncle didn't see a plane. All of this is hearsay.
My uncle says for the last 20 years, he didn't know that anybody was interested in the deaths of the Hmong people. He agreed to do this interview because you were interested. You know, what happened to the Hmong happened, and the world has been uninterested for the last 20 years. He agreed because you were interested. That the story would be heard and that the Hmong deaths would be documented and recognized. That's why he agreed to the interview. That the Hmong heart is broken, that our leaders have been silenced, and what we know has been questioned again and again is not a surprise to him or to me. I agreed to the interview for the same reason. That Radiolab was interested in the Hmong story. That they were interested in documenting the deaths that happened. There was so much that was not told. Everybody knows that chemical warfare was being used. Well, how do you create bombs if not with chemicals? We can play the semantics game. We can. But I'm not interested. My uncle is not interested. We have lost too much heart and too many people in the process. I think the interview is done.
That caused you and Robert and your whole team a lot of consternation, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this was a moment where when that interview happened, I wasn't in that interview, but when I heard it, we talked for months about whether we should use that. We felt pretty sure that we didn't handle that correctly in the interview. But I was very adamant that if we're going to do this story, we actually need to air the interview. Now that it has happened, it felt important in some way. Because we were focused on a very narrow scientific question, and we insisted on that in a way that felt hurtful. But in the process, we bumped into a very different kind of truth, and it felt, how do you hold both of those truths together? It felt like, in some sense, the most important question you could ask in some way.
It is a very interesting question, and to your credit, and we're about to play this now, you recorded some of that, those conversations you had internally and made them part of the podcast.
Yeah, we went back and forth and back and forth, and we decided to just have some of those conversations in the studio. This is a bit of it. Yeah, what I'm hearing her say there, not having been in this interview, is quit focusing on this Yellow Rain stuff, because when you do that, you're shoving aside the much larger story, namely that my people were being killed.
Right. What she's saying.
So you're,
and
you're
that is wrong. That is absolutely, and to my mind, that is not fair to us.
How is it not fair?
It's not fair to ask us to not consider the other stories and the other frames of this story.
The fact
that the most powerful man in the world, Ronald Reagan, used this story to order the manufacture of chemical weapons for the first time in 20 years. If the United States were to manufacture chemical weapons again and then use them, because the Russians supposedly had, then people would have died ugly deaths in the consequence of that. And that is not unimportant. That's hugely important, but it's not important to her. So should that not be important to us?
I think that until she said the things that she said at the end of that interview, I don't think that I had fully appreciated the volume of pain that was involved in that moment for them.
Yeah.
Yes, I thought her reaction was very balancing. But her desire was not for balance. Her desire was to monopolize the story, and that we can't.
I'm not sure we can say that, though.
If you listen to the words, that's what she said.
No,
she
says, I just think that they feel like their trauma has never been fully acknowledged, and that they've attached it to this because maybe they felt that they had to. They've attached it to this idea that Yellow Rain was a chemical weapon. And if Yellow Rain suddenly isn't a chemical weapon, that doesn't just invalidate the Yellow Rain. It negates their whole loss. And I think she might be right. But it's like, and I also think that the scientists are right. It's not a chemical weapon. And I also think you're right that to call it a chemical weapon has big consequences. So what do you do when three truths are right at the same time?
That's a really good question. What do you do?
Well, we put it on the air. It got a lot of negative. I mean, we were accused of, and I think rightly, of being insensitive, not just confronting somebody about, I mean, you don't ask people who were in the Holocaust, like, was it Cyclone B or was it Cyclone A? You know, it's just like, it's not polite, to say the least. So I acknowledge that. But at the end of the day, I think what we were trying to do is something that I feel like is increasingly our mission now, which is to struggle with truths that seem incompatible. And I feel like now, I mean, if leading people to moments of wonder was sort of the a chapter, I think now what we're trying to do is lead people to moments where they can hear us or our characters really struggle to hold incompatible truths to, at the same time. I mean, that's really essentially what you have here, is you have a scientific truth, a narrow one, bumping into a different kind of truth of lived experience. And it's, you can't really negate either in some way. And to have to try and hold that at the same time feels increasingly like the mission. Because, I mean, I don't have to tell you, like, in America right now, we just went through an exercise where, as journalists, it's painfully obvious the truth doesn't freaking matter, you know?
Well, that's really interesting, because I think towards the end of that episode, Robert says something like, in the end, do facts matter?
Right.
And quite recently, there was a CNN correspondent called Scotty Nell Hughes, who said, defending Donald Trump's claim that millions of people have voted illegally for Hillary Clinton, said, facts do not matter anymore. There's no such thing as facts anymore. That's right. So is Robert right? Do facts not matter?
I think facts matter to the people who want, who still care about them. I mean, facts matter. Of course they do. But I think where we've arrived is that if I can do my best job of fact checking this and doing a perfectly reported, responsible bit of investigative journalism, and I broadcast that to a million like-minded souls, I've done something good. But if the people who I really want to reach can go to a completely different corner of the internet and get a completely different truth, in some sense, facts don't matter anymore if everyone can find their own truth. And so in that environment, in these, quote, post-truth environment, I feel like the only journalism that matters is the kind that forces you to get in someone else's head and forces them to get in your head. So in a sense, forcing me to experience your truth and forcing you to experience mine. And that's not always going to be polite. It's not always going to be comfortable. Sometimes it's going to go completely wrong, as it did for us in that example. But I still think that's the most worthwhile thing, trying to cross that gap and break down the silos.
We were talking before the show about this very thing, and you were explaining how difficult it is for someone like you to actually go and talk to, as were that other half of America, because America is clearly massively divided.
Yeah.
How do you engage in that conversation where they can hear you and where you can get inside their heads?
You know, I wish I had an answer for you. I mean, this is in some sense the question we're all asking right now. A lot of journalists are wondering, well, how did we get this so wrong? How did we not see this coming? And a lot of people are wondering, how do we actually extend our reach into the parts of the country that aren't part of the liberal bubble? And it's a really hard question. I have begun to think that, I mean, because one of the things that I've done in the last 3 years is, as Radiolab has expanded and gone in different directions, I started a spin-off podcast that was looking at the U.S. Supreme Court, which is really looking at not just law, but about the civics, like what is the American idea? You know, what is America now? All of these stories and these cases that somehow point at that question. That feels to me like an incredibly vibrant question that I don't just want people who are college educated and live in the coasts to think about. I think we should all be thinking about that. But how do you get that in front of people who wouldn't be inclined to listen to a podcast and think that all NPR journalists are evil, which is what a lot of the country thinks. No matter what we say, they're not going to listen. So I've been thinking actually that maybe the next step is not just broadcasting, but actually engagement. You know, transmit the story out into the ether and hope people hear it. But then I think we need to start following that story into the places where it lands, and having conversations with people, using those stories as catalytic moments to actually have real conversation. And I don't know how to do that, but that's actually one of the things I'm thinking about for our next season of More Perfect, which is the spinoff show, is not just putting it out there, but putting it out there and then sitting in a room with people, even if it's just 10 people, and trying to see how they feel about it and explain yourself, hear their, you know, just exchange. That actual human brick and mortar exchange feels really crucial right now.
For all the reach that you have, almost 10 million downloads, does a part of you worry that you're impotent?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thought that it's 10 million people, 98% of which agree with you, that's a horrible feeling. Hmm. That feels like it can put you in an existential crisis. And that may be where we are. I'm not sure. And, you know, podcasting, for all of its glory, doesn't exactly help matters, because this is a medium where people choose you. So, you know, if I don't choose this podcast, then I'm never going to, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. There's no room for serendipity in the podcast sphere, where you can bump into someone who doesn't believe as you believe, unless you're one of those people who seeks it out intentionally, and those people are rare. So I think we have to figure that out. I mean, we in America certainly have to figure that out.
In about 5 minutes, we're going to give you a chance to ask questions. And there's got microphones there, 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 and there. And it's the usual drill. Please keep your questions short. Don't embarrass our proud nation. And give other people a chance to ask their questions. So make your way to the microphones. Now, we might bring the house lights up so people can see where they are. You've talked about not getting too comfortable, and you started questioning yourself a few years ago. And you said you want to be doing things that scare you and talking about things you shouldn't be talking about. So what's on the taboo list?
On the taboo list? That's a good one. That's a good question. I really want to have a good answer for this. What's on the taboo list? Huh.
Not snail sex, clearly.
No, snail sex is definitely like square. That's like bullseye. Yeah, I don't know. You know,
Well, what scares you?
What scares me are... this is not the taboo list, so I'm going to reframe your question.
Sure.
What scares me is all aspects of government. I'm not like a government-fearing kind of person, but I don't understand how government works, and I want to. So I find that the more that I do this, the less I'm interested in like entertaining stories, and I just want to understand how government works, how America works. So what scares me is the idea that somehow the American experiment is ending, or that we are in some way a failed nation state, because there's a lot of people like me who don't understand how it works. Mm. So I feel a great deal of urgency right now to understand and to do those kinds of stories, and to find ways that are as compelling as, you know, as Cynthia Kenyon and the thing we did with about Bob. Can we figure that out? Feels like a really important question.
That is a big challenge. On the whiteboard in the Radio Lab office, is there the great white whale story, the one you've talked about for years, which you've never landed?
There was a story. For a long, long time. This is a while back. The word colors was written on the whiteboard. Could we do a radio show? A radio show with no pictures about colors. That seemed idiotic. But then we did it, and it was great.
Yeah, very good. Although people with color deafness were furious.
Yeah.
Do we have some questions over here? If you have a question, you can speak up over here. Now is your moment. We'll give a Radiolab silence. If there's no question, we'll move over to here. Do we have a question over here?
I do. I'm wondering, because you humanize not only science, but scientists to so many people, and it's really beautiful. And for example, people like Oliver Sacks, who are no longer with us. You show us glimpses, and we see your favorite parts, but do you plan on releasing parts of interviews like that for the rest of us? And how important I don't know, that must just be so cool for you.
on occasion we've released some extended interviews with scientists. Most of the scientists we talk to are not Oliver Sacks and don't have that beautiful sort of lyric gift that he has, I would put it in the present tense because the work is still very much alive and with us. Both my parents are scientists, and for me, like, the pivotal moment or a pivotal moment in figuring out how to do this, I mean, my mother has studied one protein for 40 years. One protein. It's called CD36, and it's like a member of our family, but I've never understood what it does. And I remember one day I would ask her, like, Mom, what does it do again? And I would go to her lab every day after school, and I would hang out there, and I would play with her lab rats, and put them in my pockets, give them names, not knowing that they would soon die in the pursuit of knowledge. But I was so familiar with science, and I would ask her, like, what do you do? But I could never understand it. And I remember one day she did this thing at the kitchen table. She grabbed a plate and a cup and a salt shaker. No, maybe a napkin. I don't know. And she was like, this plate is the cell, Jad. Now, this cup over here is a globule of fat. Now imagine this globule of fat comes and it wants to get into the cell. How does it do that? I don't know, Mom. Maybe it worms its way through the cell wall? No, that's what they used to think. But I discovered that this protein, it's like this little napkin here. The cup has to go on the napkin, and then the napkin, it's sort of like a canoe. It rows the fat into the cell, like kind of crosses the River Styx and into the cell. And that's how it works. That's what the protein does. And I was like, oh, I get it. I just needed her to use, like, cutlery, you know? I needed it to happen at the kitchen table, you know? And so I think what we do is a very specific thing. We try to enable those moments with scientists where they can change the language game and they can speak with a grammar that is a more of a colloquial kitchen table grammar. I feel like that's really important. And I saw it in my own house.
How important is it to your mother to answer the question after 40 years? Does she, or is it just the journey that's the thing?
Well, you know, I mean, with CD36,
yeah.
Well, the fascinating thing, and this is another beautiful thing about science, is that, you know, initially she thought, oh, I figured it out. This thing just rows the fat into the cells. But then she figured out that if you take it away from the rats can't remember anything. So they're like, okay, clearly it has something to do with memory. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's got like two jobs. It's got like a day job and a night job. And then she figured out that it's also on the tongue, and it is responsible for a very particular taste, that umami taste. Okay, so now it's got three jobs. Mm-hmm. And now she's figuring out that it's in this lining of the heart, and it does something there too. So now it's got like four jobs. So the more she studies it, the more jobs it has. So the truth just gets more and more and more complicated the more she studies it.
So if I was a conspiracy theorist, I'd say the more she studies it, the more jobs she has.
Yeah.
That's how this works.
Probably.
Do we have a question up here? It's underneath the exit sign. There's a microphone, hopefully.
Is it on? What's your favorite Radio Lab episode?
My favorite episode is usually the last one we made. Just because it's the one that's in my mind. And I have a weird thing where, like, I can't remember our old episodes. They become a blur the moment they're over. But we did an episode a while ago about words and what happens when you learn a language. Like, let's say this thing, I don't know the word for, and then, or let's say white, okay? Or red, let's go with red, safer. If I know the word red, does this red become more red? There are people who believe that, like, if you have a word for it, it actually feeds back on your perception and it makes the thing more of that thing. And there are other people who just believe, no, it's not that at all. It's a label for this color. That's all it is. And so there's a really interesting conversation to have about, like, what happens when you learn a new word? What happens in the mind? And we did a series of stories about that in an episode called, it was an hour called Words. And I happen to have a four-year-old right now who's learning a new word every day. And I always think, like, what's happening in the mind of that little dude every time he learns the word for some new thing? So that episode for me kind of keeps coming up in my mind. So maybe that's my favorite.
By the way, we've left, we got about another 15, 20 minutes. So if people are kind of a bit shy or have been trying to think of the question, you've got time. We want to give you time. This is a chance to meet Jad and ask him what you want to ask him. Do we have anyone up here, far away?
Good evening, Jad. Welcome to the world's most livable city.
Super livable.
Thank you.
I was just saying that. And it's funny that that's the adjective I landed on. I was like, this is the most livable city I've ever been in. And it turns out that's just a thing people say about Melbourne the time.
I'm a primary teacher, and I greatly admire your questioning skills. And I'm just wondering, spur of the moment, best question you could ask a 10-year-old, open, deep question to get him thinking.
Best question I could ask a 10-year-old. Whoa. any answer I give this is just going to be a failure. why? You know how kids ask why constantly? My kid, I'm looking in this direction. Am I looking in the right direction?
Up a bit.
Yeah, up on the top.
Okay. Oh,
yeah,
hello.
You're right.
Okay.
That's perfect. Just why?
maybe that's just...
You got one sitting there that you're like on the whiteboard, you know, which one's coming up or anything like that?
I remember there's a question we wrote down, and I can't remember the origin of it, but there was a question, what does it mean to be a dolphin? I remember that question was on the whiteboard for a long, long time. And I can't tell you why it was there, but I remember looking at that and being like, what does it mean to be a dolphin? The question almost doesn't make any sense, but...
Since you bring up dolphins, can I counteract that with who's having more fun, us or the dolphins?
I'd have to go with the dolphins at this point. Hands down, after the election, Christ.
Douglas Adams would agree with you. Is sometimes a good question more valuable than a good answer?
Certainly. I mean, it's a funny thing. Like, I feel like you have to ask questions and actually want to find the answer. It can become a kind of a mannerism to simply ask the question and kind of, you know, who knows? That feels wrong. Like, you really do need to try and answer it. But the best questions are the ones that lead to that don't actually have the easy answer. What they do is generate the next question. It's a slightly bigger question. And then that leads you on an adventure. And then you get a slightly bigger question. Those are the best questions. The questions that somehow have babies.
That's nice. Now, I don't wish to put pressure on this side of the audience, but you signally failed before when given the opportunity to ask Jad a question. So we're going to come back to you now, and we don't want to be judging you, so fire away.
Pressure. So one of my favourite things that you guys do is, you know, you start a story and it's one thing and then it turns into another. And it seems like maybe that's what Radio Lab is for you as an experience, that, you know, it started as one thing and it's turning into another. How much do you think that is going to happen to you in the future? That, you know, you obviously talk about how it is one thing right now and how you both each have your ideas. You know, do you expect that to continue and continue finding new things?
Yeah, I hope so, or else we just have to hang it up. Yeah. I mean, Radiolab is just, it's the things you want to think about when you wake up in the morning. Like, that's all Radio Lab is. We all get up in the morning and we want to think about something, and whatever we choose to think about is what the show is. And we continue to sort of think about new things. If it ever becomes a routine or a loop, then that's the moment to stop. And so it has to continue. I mean, when we initially called it Radio Lab, it wasn't lab as in science, it was lab as an experiment. So I feel like our mission is embedded in the name. We have to continue to experiment.
You kind of make that sound almost easy, though, like we just think about new things. But that's actually incredibly hard, what you described earlier, which is that thing that makes you want to explain it to somebody else. You don't find those every day. So how much of your thinking time and your team's thinking time is spent throwing ideas at the wall, seeing which ones make you want to go the whole journey?
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten a lot harder to find stories, that's for sure. And we spend We used to spend maybe 30% of our time looking for stories, and now we spend a whole lot longer than that, maybe 60, 70% of our time. Because, you know, we were an explainer show for a really long time, and now we still do that some, but we are looking for, again, that thing we were talking about, the multiple truths, stories and experiences that somehow you see that unfolding, which is a much harder thing to find. It's easier to find things that you want to explain, that you find fascinating, but what we're trying to do now, it just takes a whole lot more looking.
And what percentage of your story ideas that are thrown around in the office would actually get up?
You know, I mean, we probably, it's 10 to 1, I would say, in terms of ideas that are pitched that you then select. And of those that you select, 10 to 1 that actually make it on the air. But, you know, you're generating so many ideas and you're working on so many stories at once. And you're basically playing the odds, you know. The odds are if I have 30 stories in progress, 11 will win. But, you know, these are like, you know, when I say in progress, you've done an interview. You've made a couple of phone calls. You keep that going, but it, you know, so often the truth is not as exciting as you expect, or there's no shape to the story, or you can't find the right character, or the character doesn't want to talk, and so you kill it, you know? And I'd say we kill more than many more stories than we actually make it.
That's interesting. Do we have a question over here?
In your show, The Ring and I, you interviewed a man whose name I forget, but who said that Wagner's mission was to get inside his audience and stir them up. And I'm wondering if you realised at the time, whether you intended it or not, that Radiolab was going to have just that impact on your audience.
I mean, Wagner is in a special category, so I wouldn't take that in comparison too far. He literally wanted to sort of like own and his audience, mind, body, and soul, and change their lives, and then in the process change the world. I would never be quite so megalomaniacal as to want all of those things, but you do want. I mean, the thing we all want, the stories you look for, are stories of transformation. You know, where somebody is just getting their coat on, they're walking out the door, and they run smack into some reality that just takes their little perspective and shakes it, throws them out as a new person. That's what we look for in a story, and that's what you want when you're hearing a story. You want that experience of having your life changed, even just a little bit. And so, in some sense, every story has to have in it latent the possibility. So you choose ideas that feel perspective-shaking, you know? You never count on the fact that they're going to land the way you want, because most of the time they don't. But you put it out there with this sort of naive hope that it will change someone's life, because it's in the process of making it, it's changed yours.
And can I, just by way of example, when I've been telling people I'm going to talk to Jad, I talk about Radiolab, and as an example of how well you and these guys set up a story, there was an episode they did on Time, which started with this piece of music which sounded weird, like a Gregorian chant, and you hear Jad say, "You know this piece of music. Everyone knows this piece of music." And I'm thinking, "I don't know this piece of music." And he said, "Everybody knows this." And then he says, "It's Beethoven's Fifth, but it's Beethoven's Fifth when slowed down over 24 hours, which is how a whale would hear it." Now, what a brilliant way to get into an episode about Time. You may not remember that, but I do.
Yeah. I remember that one, actually.
Oh, you remember now, did you?
Yeah, well.
Yeah, okay.
You basically just, yeah, sorry.
He is a little bit lagged. Do we have a question? One last round up there on the balcony on the left.
Jad, love the show, and thanks for coming out. Just wondering if you're considering a CRISPR part two.
Yeah, we are actually. Here's a not so funny inside baseball bit about that. So that was a podcast that we released about CRISPR. We called it Part One. And I had a story planned for Part Two, which was not about CRISPR. It was about computer viruses. The story fell through, as they do. We killed it. And so we ended up releasing something that said Part One with no Part Two. And it is the single most frequent email we get, which is, "Where's Part Two?" I think I could have released a story called Mr. Potato Head, Part One. And it's just inherently suspenseful. People are like, okay, where's part two? Where is it? Come on. But you know what? I think we are going to do part two because CRISPR, apparently, it's one of the weird things. It's like every so often, like once a generation, a scientific concept will just break through and become embraced by the mainstream in this way that's really unexpected. And this is the thing. The CRISPR has become symbolic of so many things to non-scientific audiences. And there's so much more to say about it. So we may actually end up revisiting CRISPR. I think we will.
Is this what to do with your half-story idea? Is really mess with your audience's mind and just release them as whatever, part two? So they think, yeah. Oh, well, I must have missed the first part.
Right. Yeah. We actually had part one of CRISPR, and then I think we had a part one of a different thing. So we're just like proliferating part ones and not having part two.
Start with the sequel, I think, is the way to go. Do we have a question up here?
Yeah, hi, Jed. Thanks for coming to Melbourne and Australia. My question was around, like, I feel like podcasting is really flourishing at the moment and More Perfect's been so great. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about topics or areas or a particular idea for a podcast that you think would be really cool that hasn't been done yet. Yeah.
I have an idea. What about a podcast about a crime? Oh, wait. No, podcasts about... I would love there to be more podcasts. Okay, here's the thing. Let me get on the soapbox for a second. Look, I'm a huge fan of podcasts. Obviously, it has become what I do. I would like more public service podcasts to be out there. There's a lot of like really entertaining cold case kind of podcasts. There's a lot of comedy podcasts, which I love, by the way. I want podcasts that actually are going to make the world a better place. So I want podcasts that somehow have that old, like just like fuddy-duddy, but old school journalistic intent to go out and make the world better. And to speak truth to power. I want those kinds of podcasts, but exciting. So can you do that podcast? A podcast that changes the world that's exciting? Yeah, all right, that's my gift to you.
I look forward to Sanitation, the podcast. We've got maybe 3 or 4 more minutes, so this is a chance. If anybody's at a microphone, this is the last chance to ask Jad something before he's gone forever. Just gone. I know that's a little dramatic, but that's the kind of man he is. Any last questions?
I have actually observed that I am one of the youngest listeners here, and I was wondering what age classification were you aiming it at originally?
How old are you?
10.
10. Nice. 10 works. I mean, I don't think about it in terms of I think unconsciously when we're, I don't think of it. Okay, when we're making the stories, I'm not thinking about the audience. Because it's too scary. Like, if you guys were all present in the studio, that would freak me out. We would never do anything because we would get too self-conscious. So you think about, okay, I work with a guy named Robert Kroll, which he's a genius. If I can make him interested, then okay. That's so I measure it in very sort of small, colloquial ways. I want Robert. I'm aiming it at Robert. And then we have a bunch of producers of different ages, and so I'm aiming it at them. I'm trying to make them get it. At the same time, you never want to talk in a way that someone like yourself couldn't get it. So 10 to 100? That's a cop-out, I realize. But you know, I want you to like it, and I also want someone like me to like it, and I want someone who's just... anyone who's curious. I guess that's the simple litmus.
You're not the 10-year-old son of the man that asked, what do we ask 10-year-old children? I just wondering. Jad, you actually have done a public service, and you made it interesting, and you've reintroduced the concept of wonder, which is a beautiful thing. Will you please thank Jad Abumrad?
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.